The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Runes, the 2018 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2018. You may make additional copies of this recording for use by your school, but please do not sell any copies of the recording. Learn more about classical Christian education and ACCS at classicalchristian.org.
All right, I think we're going to get started. How loud is that? Is that good? Is that overpowering? Is it like a Marshall stack at 10? Is it good? All the way in the back? Excellent. All right. Well, it's 3:10. We'll get started here. Obviously, if we're talking about starting a course, there's just a lot to cover. So did everyone get a syllabus when you walked in? Just sort of a scope and sequence syllabus. There's some in the back there for aesthetics in your school. And also at 4:30, I'm doing a transformative teacher training little meeting at the gatherings, I think just across the hall in Rock Hill Room. Does anyone know where the Rock Hill Room is? Is it right there? Okay, great. So that's at 4:30. And so if you want to come on over there and talk about ideas for teacher training and faculty development that kind of develop a lot of the things we're talking about here at the conference, that's what we'll do there. So I have a little presentation, but then I'll open it up to you and we can talk about what you're struggling with as an administration or a faculty or what have you, and how we can and bring some inspiring classical solutions to those struggles. So this workshop is Redeeming the Senses, How to Start an Aesthetics Class at Your School. If you don't know what aesthetics is, or you're just intrigued by that lovely title, I'll tell you up front, it has actually nothing to do with cosmetic surgery, which is what you'll, if you Google aesthetics, that's the first thing you'll find. I'm sure I'd make a lot more money doing that, but I'll give you a basic overview of my own aesthetics class, how I run it, just to generate your ideas and give you a sense of what you could be doing. I've done this class at Tollegs Classical School in the high school, and I've done it at Eastern University as well. And I'll give you the rationale for why we're studying aesthetics. I'll give you some key teaching points throughout that I think are very helpful. A bit of a scope and sequence, some reading, and some assignments and evaluation. Basically everything you need to start a course. Chris Schlecht was giving me a hard time last night when I told him what the workshop was going to be about. And he said, well, that's easy. You know, you find a teacher, you get a book, and you start. And I said, go away. We need to give you more than that. And that's what we'll do. So let's begin here with what is aesthetics and why do we teach it? Aesthetics is a Greek term, and it comes from the verb aisthanome, which means sense perception, to apprehend by means of the senses. We're a bit more familiar, perhaps, with the word anesthetic, right, which involves the numbing or the deprivation of sense perception. But in terms of its association with art and beauty, it doesn't actually get explicitly associated until about 1750 in a tract that was published by a fellow by the name of Alexander Baumgarten. And this is right around the time you had what are called the nouveau riche developing in Europe, a new kind of upper middle class through mercantilism. And you had a whole new kind of you had a new market that was willing to spend money on culture. So Beethoven was the first real composer to kind of break free of either being a court composer or composing for a church. He was a freelance composer, and he would go out, rent concert halls, sell tickets to these new upper middle class people, and they would come in and they would sell out the place, and he did very well with it. Well, right around that time, you have this term aesthetics developing to try to talk about how to determine the value of an artwork, largely for purchase, interestingly enough. And so generally now the term is associated with the study and the encounter of art and beauty. In a distinctively Christian sense, aesthetics involves how the senses are in fact awakened. And we'll talk more about this. I actually have a book for you on it. How the senses are awakened, how they're restored from their fallen slumber, redeemed, as it were, from their fall, through the study and the encounter of artworks and the wonder of beauty. Right now, all we need to take with us is that aesthetics has both an objective and a subjective dimension. Objectively, it involves studying and encountering art and beauty. And then subjectively, it has this notion of awakening the senses and the awe and the loves of the student who's studying and encountering that beauty. Now, my aesthetics class is for 11th graders and of course, college students. And I'd strongly recommend that you save aesthetics for around 11th or 12th grade. And I'm going to give you a little anecdote to kind of show you why I think that's the case. It's sort of informal empirical evidence. But I find that if they're 10th, 9th, 8th grade, they're just not there yet. They can't really quite receive what you're teaching yet. The brain hasn't developed. And then I'll share with you an anecdote of why that is or how that works itself out. So why do we teach it? Why do we teach a class on aesthetics? Well, very much for the same reasons that we talked about yesterday, and the need to teach beauty to our faculty and to infuse beauty in every aspect of our school culture. We in a classical Christian education environment put a lot of emphasis on those three cosmic values of the true, the good, and the beautiful. And we're good when it comes to truth, and we're pretty good when it comes to goodness, largely, again, through the worldview movement, since Francis Schaeffer. We're very good with being able to explain to students why something is true. And we're very good at expressing the kind of moral obligations to which they're bound as creatures redeemed in Christ and school etiquette and standards and the like. But when it comes to beauty, that's where a lot of confusion kicks in, even for faculty members. And we have to be really, really careful about that. I have encountered people in the past who told me that truth and goodness are objective, but beauty is subjective. I've been told that by people. Well, the Bible doesn't tell me anywhere that, you know, Bach is better than, who should I pick, you know, Justin Bieber, right? And so now I'm told there's truth, I'm told there's goodness, but I'm not told that there's any objective standard of beauty. And one of my first responses to that is that, well, besides reminding them that Adam and Eve were first placed in what? Strip mall? Where were they placed? In paradise, right? Which is literally the epiphany of beauty. And the cross is paradise restored. That's why the cross can be beautiful. The cross transfigures everything. Something that's so ugly and so associated with death, it can transfigure into a paradisical symbol of life. And if he can do that with a cross, he can do that with anything. Yeah. So, but besides that, because then that involves me having to buy them coffee and talk it for a while, I instead remind them that truth, goodness, and beauty need each other and they imply one another. And if you are going to be a relativist with beauty, you've snuck relativism in through the back door. And I can promise you, if they're relativists with beauty, truth and goodness will follow. Guaranteed. They need each other and they imply one another. So we tend to be very confused when it comes to the notion of beauty. And so bringing that clarity, precision, understanding, and indeed, most importantly, encounter with our students, I think is really important. They should not leave your schools. They should not graduate without being able to articulate in a very precise manner and indeed experience what beauty really is. Does that make sense? So that's what an aesthetics class does for them. It brings to bear explicitly. I do it over a course of a semester. I don't do an entire year. I do 2 marking periods. It's just because I started it at the university, and so then I just transferred it over to the classical school. So it's, you could do it for a year, no problem. There's nothing necessitating that it only be a semester. But you've got to have something there where they're going to be talking about and wrestling with beauty explicitly for some time. All right, so before we get into even discussing beauty, I have the students read a book over the summer, and this is their introduction to my aesthetics class. It's a book by Stratford Caldicott. It's called Beauty for Truth's Sake on the Reenchantment of Education. They do have to turn in a 2-3 page response paper to a prompt. How does this reading awaken your sense of the true, the good, and the beautiful? If you're not familiar with the book, it's basically an overview of the quadrivium. You guys familiar with the quadrivium? So you've got your trivium, right? Your grammar, dialectic, and rhetoric. But that's actually just 3 of the 7 liberal arts. The other 4 are going to be more mathematical, so arithmetic, geometry, music, and astronomy. And remember, they didn't see mathematics as like prepping for standardized tests or anything like that. They saw mathematics as the patterns of perfection upon which the entire cosmos was modeled, and they applied to all of art, all of creation, as it were. So the study of beauty for the classical mind involved inevitably the study of applied, well, mathematics itself, and then applied mathematics. And so this is what Beauty for Truth's Sake does. It takes the students through, in each chapter, how beauty relates to numbers and shapes, to music, cosmology, and the like. And it's really beautiful because in, you know, classical thought, the world is held together through the logos, right? Is everyone familiar with that? So you know your Avatar fans. What are your 4 elements of the cosmos? Earth, air, fire, and water, right? Everyone should know that. That's huge. Earth, air, fire, and water, okay? Those are your 4 elements of the cosmos. Empedocles, 5th century BC, is the one who really starts putting those together, okay? But then they wanted to know what bound it all together, what held earth, air, fire, and water in this perfect harmony. And it had to be something other than an element of the cosmos. So they started, the Greeks called it the logos. Heraclitus, around that time, 5th century, was calling this principle that holds and binds the entire universe together as the logos. In Latin, it would be like the quintessence, right? The 5th essence that holds everything together. And it's really cool because for the classical mind, 4 is a symbol of the cosmos. Earth, air, fire, and water. That's why you talk about like the 4 corners of the universe, right? So how many gospels are there? And who is the logos that holds it all together? Isn't that cool? So the 4 gospels, just by their sheer number, reveal that the entire cosmos is being reconfigured around Christ, the true Logos, who became flesh, who died and rose again. Right? So this book gives them all those frames of reference, and it gets them ready for a class in aesthetics. It's really quite neat. So I would recommend that reading for you in general, even just for a faculty discussion. So that's the first place we start. And we start just by spending a few class, basically a week just talking through the book and asking the students what they liked and what they found they were fascinated by. I do thesis supervisions as well. We've gotten several theses that came out of this book. Students who are generally math inclined in general, but who also love music and art, boy, they just put them together and they blossom into this real classical vision of beauty, inspired largely through the interaction of art and number. Then we get into the study proper, and what I generally begin with is the three schools of aesthetics. I'm not dogmatic in any way. Again, it's really just to generate their moral imagination and get them thinking and giving them frames of reference to be able to talk about artwork sort of intelligibly as well. Now, for time's sake, I'm not going to go over each one, but basically, most scholars would argue that aesthetics breaks down to more or less three different schools of thought, and they're not mutually exclusive. They can all work together. Representation, formalism, and expressionism. And so for, just for time's sake, I'll do one of them. Representation is probably the most popular one. In other words, how does art do what it does? What makes art art, in other words? And the representationalists will say that art functions very much like a metaphor. Art functions very much like a metaphor. Those of you who know Jeremy Begbie's work, this is how he sees art. Art is very much as a metaphor. And what is a metaphor? Well, if I take a statement like, you know, my love for you is like a rose. I know it's a simile, but leave me alone. My love for you is like a rose. What's going on there? Well, if you think about that, if I'm presenting to my wife a rose, is it because she likes botany? I give her a rose because what is that rose? What is it? It's a symbol. Now, you have to remember, in the classical imagination, the entire world is a symbol. Entire cosmos is a symbol and made up of lots of symbols. So symbols aren't empty, right? Language is symbolic and words are not empty, right? In the beginning was the, right? So God creates through, right? Words are symbols that reveal something that you can't see. That's representationalism. Have you ever seen love? Where is it? How big is it? What does it smell like? Well, it smells like a rose, doesn't it? Right. Representationalism sees often intangible, immaterial realities represented through tangible, material symbols. Right? It's very sacramental in that sense. Representationalism sees immaterial, often very spiritual, right? Intangible realities revealed through very tangible, material, and substantial entities. And so, you know who is really wild with that? I'll give you a modern art example. And I'm not a big modern art guy, to be honest, probably to my fault, but Andy Warhol. One of the things I do is I should have brought the slide here. I show the students a picture of a Brillo box. Remember Brillo boxes? You probably have seen it. It's typical Andy Warhol. And I show them a picture of a Brillo box, and I say, you know, that's in an art museum in New York City. Why? And the students get very frustrated. They're like, well, maybe because it's the first one of its kind. Okay. So they're trying to think what makes that Brillo box special. That's a good gauge of deciding why something is art. And I pushed them and I said, well, actually it's not. It's a totally random box that he bought. Well, maybe it's because of the balance of the colors and the color scheme and so forth. And I said, well, yeah, it is. The advertiser did a nice job, but why is it in an art museum? We keep pushing them and keep pushing them. And then finally, I reveal it to them. They're looking at a Brillo box, and they're asking the question, why is this art? Now, what Brillo box on the planet would you ask that question to? In other words, the Brillo box transfigured into something more. Just like that rose was a symbol of my love, the Brillo box became a symbol of this modern question, what is art? And hence it transfigures into something that's bigger than a Brillo box. So that was Andy Warhol's attempt to kind of show you, this is what art does. This is what art is. I give my wife a rose, and I say, this is my love for you. And I turn around, and I walk, and I get hit by a bus, and I'm gone. And then all of a sudden, a big wind came and sweeps that rose away. Is it going to help to say, oh, don't worry, we'll just get you another rose? Is it going to help? Why not? Because that rose is not a rose anymore. That rose transfigured. That was the symbol of my love. It revealed it. Something happened to it. Art, through this process of representationalism, transfigures the world. It's a very transfigurative thing. And therefore, it transfigures us when we encounter it. We'll talk a bit about that more when we get into gazing. So we get into these things. This will take a few weeks with the different schools of thought and the like. And then we get into truth, goodness, and beauty proper. So the first frames of reference that I give them are the schools of thought of what art is. How does art do what it does? And then we start getting into the real classical world, and that's the world of truth, goodness, and beauty. Now, I do have a teacher resource for you, and I'm gonna, because I'm into this and because I write, you're going to have a lot of my stuff on there. I promise you, as Woody Allen once said, I promise you I'm not a narcissist. If I were Greek, I would not, if I were an ancient Greek, I would not identify with narcissists. I would identify with Zeus. So, see if you're awake at 3 o'clock, right? So, but this book is a teacher resource on Awakening Wonder, and it's a classical guide to truth, goodness, and beauty. And I wrote this because, again, I sensed that there was, even in my life especially, a bit of a confusion of how truth, goodness, and beauty all kind of fit together in this coherent whole that we can then convey to our students in a really astonishing sort of way. And so that's what that's for. So we get into, in depth, the whole notion of the beauty side of the true and the good. And I get students telling me something every year. This is their favorite class that I teach. That's one of the things I hear. And the other thing I hear is, you know, Dr. Turley, I always felt like something was missing in my worldview and in my theology. I found it. This is it. It's beauty. Now it completes it all. And they get so excited. They are so, quite literally, enamored, in love with beauty. Because that's what beauty is supposed to do, is awaken our loves, right? We talked about that a lot in yesterday's workshop on Beauty Matters. I give to them, as an assignment, Plato's Symposium. A heads up, there's a little homoeroticism in there, which they actually find kind of funny and a little, it's very interesting. You know, the Greeks generally had no problem with homosexuality, but they never dreamed of calling it marriage. Never. I mean, they wouldn't even have thought, what, do you want to kill our civilization or something? So you can have very interesting conversations there. But it's Diotima's speech in there. I don't think it's on your slide. Diotima is D-I-O-T, and I believe it's I-M-A, right? Divine honor, I think. Diotima's speech. That's probably the single most influential discourse on beauty in the ancient world, in the classical world. Everything else from that point forward is almost a footnote to Diotima's speech on beauty in the Symposium. So if you just want to read an excerpt from there, that would be it. That is the fixed historical point of when the Western civilization vocabulary of beauty really started to take off. So we start there. We start with Plato's Symposium. The huge takeaway from that is that beauty is not a personal sentiment. That's huge. You got to get that. Beauty is not liking pistachio ice cream or anything like that. It's not a personal sentiment. Beauty, first and foremost, is a... Does anyone know what the word I'm going to use from yesterday? It's a physics. And all my science colleagues love it. They're like, yes, the one metaphor to use for beauty is physics. And it is. Beauty holds the world together. Ravi Jain, Alcuin Fellow, he talks about this all the time, that classical Christian thought, as well as classical thought, Empedocles onward, was the idea that somehow, some way, love holds the world together. Why do things move? Why do things generate? Out of love. They're being drawn to something, as it were. And when the Logos becomes flesh and lives out, dies, and rises again, that love, the world transfigures. Everything changes. Beauty now is understood in a whole far more magnificent and cosmic way. So beauty is a physics. Beauty is all about the loveliness, the delightfulness, the radiance of the true and the good. Beauty is the loveliness, it's the delightfulness, it's the ray. Plato uses the metaphor of a sun's rays to describe beauty. And what it does is it awakens within us, when we encounter it, love and desire. And when we desire something, what's our orientation towards it? When we desire something, do we walk away from it? Or what? We're drawn to it. So that's why we associate beauty with attraction, right? Beauty is a physics. It draws me somewhere. And by definition of the beautiful, it's got to draw me to the true and to the good. Now, we talked about this yesterday. One of the first things you're going to have to deal with, and the Greeks recognize this, is that I'm not attracted only to true and good things, right? That's the subjective element of beauty. That's very real. It's very true. I'm not just... Think about the way Eve fell in the garden. She desired the fruit. She was attracted to the fruit. She found it good, right? Desirable to make one wise. So the affections are being drawn to something that is not good, that is not true. Right? So what you have to do, and we talked about this in detail yesterday, what you have to do is you have to talk to them about the differences between the muses and the sirens. What's the difference? Right? The muses are the daughters of Zeus that inspire acts of truth, goodness, and beauty, that draw you up into life. What are the sirens? Right? They're sea nymphs that do what? They draw you down into death, right? Literally into Hades, right? They see the sea as Hades. Now, how do they do it? They do it with a false beauty, don't they? Well, how do we know it's false? Because where does it lead you? Right? One leads you up, and the other one leads you down. And you can tell objectively because of what happens, but you can also tell subjectively. Beauty, by definition, awakens love. Eros, they would call it. And love, by definition, surrenders itself to the object of its attraction. This is Plato in his Symposium. Beauty awakens love, and love, by definition, surrenders itself to the object of its attraction. False beauty does not awaken love. What's the opposite of love? Lust, right? I almost got in trouble. I told the story yesterday. I almost got in trouble. It was in an aesthetics class, and I said, what's the opposite of love? You know, it's this quiet, intense moment. They all said, well, can we say that word? You know, I'm like, come on, what's the opposite of love? They'd say, lust. And I'm like, yeah, do you know what lust is? And they were all quiet. I'm like, what is he talking about? Do you know what lust? And I couldn't help it. I said, I'm going to show you what lust is. And everyone's like, what? They thought I was, I'm still off my job. I said I was talking about Plato, right? What is lust? Is it surrendering yourself to the object of your affection? No, it's trying to control and dominate that object, right? Love surrenders. Love bends the knee. Love serves. Lust seeks to control and to dominate and to manipulate. Right? Now, the only way you know the difference is if there's objective beauty. If beauty is out there and it by definition awakens love, now I have a basis to know the difference between that and the false beauty that awakens lust. Does that make sense? Truth attracts, lies seduce. Truth attracts, lies seduce. Aesthetics class is really neat because in terms of spiritual formation, students just absolutely eat this stuff up because now they know the difference, and we're in a culture today that doesn't know the difference between love and lust. And we don't know the difference between love and lust because we do not believe in objective beauty. You kill objective beauty, and you have killed the distinction between love and lust. It's gone. Now it's, what is it? It's whatever I prefer. Whatever turns me on is now beautiful. All right? Does that make sense? You get a feel for that? Okay. And then we get into, and that's all very much in Plato. Then we get into the Christian reappropriation of beauty as it all now is reconstituted around Christ, the true Logos, to which, who is drawing all things unto himself. We get into Gregory of Nyssa, Dionysius, Augustine, Aquinas. These are just little excerpts of there that I actually have them read a couple of chapters from my book, just because the excerpts are there. And so we've got some key teaching points here. The key takeaway is that a distinctively Christian vision of truth, goodness, and beauty involves a Christ-centered cosmology where beauty by its nature, notice the physics, draws us into an encounter with Christ. And so truth, goodness, and beauty are thus reflective of a new creation that comes forward into time and is revealed in the present to draw us to that future. And then the final thing I teach them as part of sort of this theoretical, you know, ground laying is this notion of redeeming the senses. In the Christian tradition, it's not just the soul that has fallen. The senses have fallen as well. The body has fallen as well. In the patristics, you'll see this notion that when Adam and Eve are covered by the garments of shame, there's a sense that there is now a barrier between the way they could have sensed beauty in the garden, but now because they've been cast out, their senses become numb to beauty. I like asking students, have you ever had, you know, this great meal in front of you and everyone's enjoying it, but you have a really bad cold? And what's it like to eat that food? You just can't taste it. Or if you've ever seen Robin Williams in Hook, the Disney Hook, he can't see the food that they're all enjoying and eating. He's numb to it. In that case, that would be his imagination. But there's a sense that it's there for us to enjoy. God's, like we just heard Doug Wilson talking about, God's beauty and his majesty are there, but sin clouds our capacity to experience it. And so what the redeeming of the senses is all about is that through the incarnation and the restoration of the cosmos in Christ, the redemption of the senses involves the role of the arts in reawakening our senses and thus preparing our bodies for their future resurrection when Christ returns. And it's here that I have them read this book by Vigen Guroian called The Fragrance of God. Has anyone read that? Anyone familiar with that book? Excellent. Yeah, a couple there. Very good. We actually buy that for them. It's only a few bucks. It's a small little book. We buy that from them. They keep it. They do a number of response papers through it. And it's a beautiful theology of gardening. And as part of that, the first chapter is all about this notion of restoring the senses. And I have to tell you, the students just eat this stuff up. I've had several students focus on fragrance and scent as their final project at the end of the course, which we'll talk about at the end. So here I'm building a foundation for the students. The foundation involves understanding the three schools of aesthetics, understanding the whole classical Christian notion, the true, the good, and the beautiful, and its role in the Christian life, and then the application of it in the redemption of the senses and preparing the body for its future resurrection when Christ returns. So that's aesthetic theory. And then we get into aesthetic practice. And here, I tend to focus on four areas. You don't have to limit it to that, but this is what I focus on. Music, art, architecture, and food. The best. Music, art, architecture, and food. You can branch off into all kinds of areas, but these are the four that I've found just most conducive with our students. There are four areas of life we encounter daily. We hear music pipe through every intercom. You can't even go into the elevator without hearing music. We see images all around us. We inhabit space, and we eat every day. So I want them to kind of rethink the world around them, but now with this sort of sanctified sense and imagination. So let's start with music. In terms of what I want them to take away from our study of music, and again, we did a little bit of this yesterday as well, I want them to first understand that music is revelatory. Music reveals or discloses to our senses an unseen reality. This is one of the most amazing characteristics of music. So can you imagine, one of the ways I explain it to them, can you imagine going to, say we're going to, I don't know, Return of the King, you know, movie, or Star Wars, whatever it is, in a great battle scene, and the music is blaring, and the bombs are exploding, and swords are going, and it's just so exciting. All of a sudden, you're watching, and all of a sudden, the surround sound kicks out, and there's no sound whatsoever. The movie keeps going, but there's no sound. Now, will that affect the way you enjoy that film? Has anything changed on the screen? Has one pixel changed? Nothing has changed by what you can see. Nothing has changed. What's changed? A dimension of our experience that we cannot see, but it is really there. And it profoundly affects and shapes us. Music reveals an unseen reality. Another way of putting it, it's kind of playing with words, music makes visible the invisible. This is why I think music tends to be so associated with divine reality. Same with fragrance, interestingly enough. Right? Because you're experiencing something with your senses that you can't see. Okay? So that's the first thing I want them to understand about music. The second thing is that music is cosmic in nature, and that's where you get into the whole Pythagorean notion of the music of the spheres, that the world is really held together through frequencies and sonic vibrations and movement, as it were. And so the world is really very much a symphony. Now, we can't hear this music because we tend to be fallen or we tend to be too far away, but we can access it through mathematics. Remember, mathematics for the Greeks are the divine patterns of perfection upon which the entire world is modeled. And for the Greeks, too, music was not fundamentally something that was played or practiced or composed. Music was the mathematics. And if mathematics are these divine patterns of perfection, what's interesting is you can't see them. Numbers are actually invisible. We have to use symbols, a symbol system, whether it's Arabic or Greek, Roman. What was kind of cool is back in the day, they were all letters, right? Roman numerals are letters. Greek numbers or letters, all that kind of stuff. So they kind of communicated this reality, this divine reality, because they're so perfect and all that sort of stuff. So we can't see numbers, but we can hear them. We can hear them in the frequencies of the pitches, or we can hear them in the ratios of intervalic relationships, you know, octaves, thirds, perfect fifths, and the like. And so when we sing, there's a real sense that we begin embodying those patterns of perfection upon which the entire cosmos is modeled, and hence, in a very real way, we realize, we manifest the harmony of the cosmos in our midst. And even Pythagoras went all the way. He would say, and hence we transform into heavenly beings. Right. So really, really cool stuff. That's music of the spheres. And the church draws this concept in as it reconfigures around Christ and reveals heaven on earth. That's why the choir lofts in the old churches. Where are the choir lofts? Well, I gave it away. Right? I called it a loft. Right? It's up. It's heaven breaking into the world. Thirdly, music is moral. This is a very important dimension here. Acoustic revelation of divine meaning and purpose serve to cultivate wisdom and virtue within the listener, and thereby participate in the harmony of the cosmos. Make sure we understand those two words. We talked about it yesterday, wisdom and virtue. Okay, those are real important in classical education. C.S. Lewis would say that's the heart of classical education. So wisdom is understanding the divine meaning and purpose inherent in the world around us. Wisdom is understanding the divine meaning and purpose in the world inherent all around us. Virtue is learning to love that divine meaning and purpose. Have you come across the phrase Ordo Amoris from Augustine? The Ordo Amoris, right, is the right ordering of our loves. If you're in my workshop, I use the example all the time. So I looked at students and I say, you know, it's good to love a baby and it's good to love a ham sandwich, right? But if they're both falling and you rush to save the ham sandwich, you understand that's a bad. The girls all get that. The boys, it takes a little time. They're hungry. But they eventually recognize, yes, that would be a bad. And why is that bad? Because you've dislodged your loves, your inclinations, your desires from God's economy of goods. Ham sandwiches are good, but babies are infinitely more good. Right? And by learning that economy of goods, God creates the world in Genesis 1, and what does he say over and over again? And it was good. And then he creates humanity, and he says, and it was very good. It's an economy. And then Eve begins to desire something that's been dislodged from that economy of goods. And so in the classical world, the world is filled with divine meaning and purpose. And we're all therefore obligated to conform our lives to that divine meaning and purpose. So education involved two things. We're going to teach our students what that divine meaning and purpose is, and then we're going to teach them to love and desire that divine meaning and purpose, and hence harmonize their lives with this cosmic piety. So what's really cool is wisdom is learning that hierarchy of goods, and virtue is learning to order our loves in accordance with that hierarchy of goods. Does that make sense? Art, and particularly music, is the bridge. Music reveals that divine meaning and purpose. That's what it's supposed to do. That's what makes good music good. It reveals that divine meaning and purpose to us so as to shape and mold our loves to be drawn up and ordered in accordance with those divine meaning and that economy of goods. Right? Does that make sense? That's why Bach is better than Justin Bieber. I didn't say Justin Bieber was bad, did I? You may want me to, but I won't. I didn't say it was bad any more than I would say a ham sandwich is bad. But it's not Bach. Does that make sense? You get the feel for that? Because music, the whole purpose of classical conception of music is to reveal a divine meaning and purpose out there that then can shape and mold me to be conformed to that divine meaning and purpose. And maybe Justin Bieber does that okay, but I promise you, he doesn't even come close to doing it the way Bach does. It doesn't even come close. And the purpose of music, classical conception of music, is to impart to you wisdom and virtue. So if that's your frame of reference, then now you can get students to go, hey, I never thought about that. So that leads me to my anecdote. I gave that exact example not too long ago. Actually, it was just this year, now I think about it. But first semester, so it felt like ages ago. I gave that very example to students in the 11th grade aesthetics class. And I don't know what it was. It was magical. They were just, I mean, it's just one of those moments you're like, I'm the best teacher in the world. They're just like, that's amazing. And they, it's a class of 21 kids, and they're just like, that's amazing. I never thought about it. So you mean I can listen to Justin Bieber? Mm-hmm, no problem, no problem. But it's not Bach. You got it. Hierarchy of goods, you got it. You got it. Wow. 2 years earlier, that same class, we talked about it the same way when they were ninth grade and they told me to go jump in a river. So that's nonsense. For you, Bach is, you know, divine meaning. But for me, Justin Bieber is divine meaning, you know? Like, and I'm like, but that doesn't make any sense. It doesn't matter. Yeah, I know for Adam, maybe, you know, the tree of life was good, but for Eve, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil was good. Are you telling me that it's the same thing? No, it's different, man. Music is different. Oh, okay. That's different. Yeah. That's a dislodged. You see, art has nothing to do with a world filled with divine meaning and purpose. But they were ninth grade and they couldn't get it. Yeah, do you wanna throw in a comment? Yeah, no. Are you pushing me along? You pushy person, what time? Oh, my. Duh. All right. Yeah, that's me. All right. I always have too much. Like, come at 4:30. We'll keep it going. We'll sneak it in. We're going to cheat, right? So music is moral. Music awakens wonder and awe. And by the way, I don't have too much when it comes to the architecture and food. So that's good. Fourthly, music is redeemed. Music is caught up into the Christian vision of life. Jesus Christ is the Logos, and therefore, he is the music that Pythagoras always wished he could hear. One of my favorite verses in the Bible is at the end of the Last Supper, as it were, and it says, at the end, you remember, right before they go into the garden, what does it say? And they sang a hymn together. And I just think that's so cool because that's what Pythagoras always wished he could hear. He heard, that's the Logos singing, you know. So, and then finally, contemporary Christian music. I would just say contemporary music in general, rock and roll, is morally ambiguous. It's a big argument. all right, here's another plug. So I have a book coming out. It should have been done by this conference. It wasn't. Shame on you, Classical Academic Press. I love them. They're the best, but they don't have it out yet. It should be out in the next couple of weeks. It's called Echoes of Eternity, A Classical Guide to Music. And I devote a chapter on this. So it's a bit of an argument. But the bottom line is, the aesthetics of rock music is purely subjective. The aesthetics of rock music is purely subjective. This is a scholarly consensus. In other words, if I'm listening to a rock tune, a contemporary tune, and it does not move my body, it ain't a good song, and it won't last. It's got to move me, all right? And then if you think about it, you could do whatever you want to the song as long as it moves people. So think about the Beatles version of I Get By with a Little Help from My Friends. And is it, what's his name, Joe Cocker? Who did, right, the Wonder Years theme, I Get By. He changed the time signature, he changed the instrumentality, he slowed it down. If he did that with a Bach piece, he would be booed out of any concert hall on the planet. He'd flunk out of a music conservatory Because classical music is about objective standards of aesthetics. It's form that draws me up into it. Rock and roll, and it's not bad. I don't say anything remotely that it's bad. Just that rock and roll is a subjective aesthetic. If it moves my body, it's cool. You get to do that. The problem is when you get into subjectivity, you lose your objective grounding for moral shaping. There's no more any kind of moral, objective moral frame of reference by which to shape my sensibilities. So what I'm just trying to make sure students recognize is that distinction and that difference. And oftentimes they're taking a rock aesthetic and applying it to Bach. Does that make sense? But I got to move on. It's developed in the book. It's a great argument, I promise. I tend to use Basil Cole, Music and Morals, and all of this reading should be in the syllabus there. All right, let's look at some sacred, I'm just going to zip through this a little bit. Sacred Sight and a Theology of Art. Jeremy Begbie has this beautiful quote, "The resurrection of the crucified humanity of Christ is itself the embryonic promise for the entire physical cosmos. In him, all things have already been made new, and in him, the destiny of creation has been set forth. Thus, to speak of Christ as the end of creation, in the manner of Revelation 3:14, is not merely to speak of his supremacy or his decisiveness in bringing, bringing creation to completion. It is also to say that in his very person, as the risen and ascended God-man, he embodies and constitutes the telos of created reality." Now that's deep. What he's basically saying is that a Christian vision of art takes sort of the goal of all of creation, which is the new creation, brings it forward into time through the artist's imagination, right, in order for us to experience the future in the present. So this is what makes Christian art so glorious and so incredibly beautiful. I do have a work, a book that just came out on gazing. They're all sold out there. If you go to the Scola table, I'll talk about it at the end for you. If you go to the Scola table, you can sign up and get it, buy it now, and then we'll send it out to you, and you won't charge you the shipping and handling. But this is a teacher resource for you to help students learn how to gaze, that is, read an artwork, right? The best way to do it is to just show you. Who knows that painting? That's great. We were talking about this last night. If you don't have this painting in your school, you're not a classical school. That was the consensus. That's the new standard. Raphael School of Athens. It's in the Vatican Library, the Pope's personal library, who commissioned it in the 16th century. And the whole purpose of it is to show the unity, right, the harmony between classical learning and Christianity. And at the heart of it here is Plato and Aristotle. Which one's Plato? Right? He's pointing what direction? Pointing up. Because for Plato, everything begins with the transcendent, true, good, and beautiful. Everything begins with God and heaven. Aristotle, it's taking all five fingers, interesting, the senses, right? And he's motioning downward. No, no, no. Everything begins inductively. Everything begins down here. And then we can draw, and he certainly believed there was a God, you know, some deistic God. And then we draw those conclusions from the particulars. Now, how does this relate to Christianity? Who was right? Does it all begin up there, or does it begin here? Yes, good answer. This is the cool part with gazing. You ask these questions to students, and the book on gazing is in a question and answer format to help you lead those questions. And we could spend hours just gazing at an artwork, right? Here's what's really cool with Raphael. What color is Plato's robe? It's reddish. That's it. What color is Aristotle's robe on the outside? It's blue. Does anyone know the significance of the colors red and blue in Christian art tradition? That's the robes worn by Christ. And it's very particular. Christ always has to have a robe inward that's red, and outward he's wrapped in blue. Mary is the opposite. Inward blue, outward red, right? And what's kind of cool with Christ is because when you take blue and red and you put them together, what color do you get? Purple. So when he's standing before Pontius Pilate in the purple robe, he's preaching the gospel of God's love that offers us eternal life, right? Because red signifies love, blue signifies eternity. Now, what's really cool, if you notice, Aristotle has his arm extended over Plato, which means he puts the blue over the red. So where do we find the perfect harmony between heaven and earth? In Christ, in the incarnation. Isn't that cool? And yes, they have disciples around them, don't they? You want to count them? I bet you can guess how many disciples there are. 5 on one side and 7 on the other. So this is an amazing way where the students look at a painting, and then it's really cool. And they, you look at that. Is that Greek architecture surrounding them? That's Roman, right? Romans are the ones who developed the vault and the domes with their cement. Right? That's Roman. As a matter of fact, it looks a lot like the Vatican, doesn't it? Do you notice the halo around Plato and Aristotle? And then what shape is the building? Well, it goes all the way down, then it comes up, but does it jet out into two sides? That's a cruciform. So the School of Athens is actually a cathedral of learning, isn't it? So this is Raphael's way of showing that this natural revelation merges beautifully and harmoniously with the special revelation, particularly of Christ. So that's gazing. That's a practice that we do, and the students really do love that. Really quickly, we go over architecture, some key points with architecture that I try to make sure that students understand is that space and self are reciprocal to one another. In many respects, our spaces are extension of ourselves, and we are inevitably extensions of space. This is why we act in certain ways when we're in certain rooms. This is why you don't scream and yell and dance in a library. And by the same token, this is why you do scream and dance or whatever in a football field or football stands and the like. Spatial arrangements reveal the nature of reality. Think about the difference between a cathedral and a strip mall. Cathedrals see reality as inherently divine, filled with divine meaning and purpose. Strip malls see reality as biology, chemistry, and physics that has no meaning apart from the meaning I choose to give to it, right? And so space just needs to be filled and in economic ways, right? Whereas you look around here, obviously they're trying to do a little more than that. You didn't need that design up there. It has no economic value. But it is trying to, what's actually making me a little dizzy the more I think about it. But anyway, it's trying to bring about some kind of aesthetic reaction, that this is a place where we encounter things in here. Reality is revealed through geometric and numerical patterns. So squares tend to represent the world, interestingly enough, because the four corners of the world, four elements of the cosmos. Circles, domes represent eternity. Triangles often represent the Trinity. Octagons, you guys know the eighth day. A lot of baptismal fonts are shaped in octagons. God creates the world in 6 days. He blesses it on the seventh day. We mess it up, so there has to be an eighth day to restore it. And so hence, the Jews worship on the Shabbat, the seventh day, but Christians worship on Sunday, the first day of the week, but the eighth day of the previous week, Right, it's been restored in Christ. I have them, and then the spatial arrangements really do affect the way we think about the world around us. That's very interesting, but again, for time's sake, we can't get too into it. I do have them re-watch, that is, a Nova special. It's on YouTube called Building the Great Cathedrals. It's a little sensationalistic in that they supposedly discover these secret codes in all these cathedrals. They've been there forever. There's nothing secret about it. But one of the cool things about it is they found that many of these cathedrals, if you use the Roman foot to measure them, many of them are 144 feet high. And, of course, you know where those numbers come from, right? Oftentimes, they have either a rectangle or a square where it measures 50 feet. The cruciform floor plan, this square in the center, represents 50 feet, Roman feet, on each side, which marks a measurement of Noah's Ark. And so it's all these very, very interesting kind of symbols that use numbers and measurements and geometry to be able to communicate divine reality. Keith Lilly's study on medieval urban planning has done a great job with that. He shows in a lot of these medieval cities, they have round walls around them signifying eternity. They'll have four gates, each signifying the four Gospels. And then the streets are orthogonal. They're straight to represent Isaiah 40, make straight the highway for our God. And then they intersect, creating crosses. And then the cathedral is placed at the centermost place. I got to study in Durham, England, just south of Scotland. And the layout of the town is very, very similar to this. And this creates... Keith Lilly's argument is for this would create a mental map of the world for the medieval mind, that the world is filled with divine meaning and purpose. And then we do food at the end. And again, key takeaways, food is revelatory of a culture's cosmology. How a culture sees the world is often reflected in its food. That should frighten us whenever we think about McDonald's or something like that, right? That the world is just basically a big, you know, consumerist mall or something. Food is sacred. Food is Edenic. Remember, we begin with the call to a meal, and the Bible ends with a meal. We fall at a meal. We're restored, as it were, through a meal, right? And the centrality of communion for Christian eating, I'm thinking here of Paul in 1 Corinthians 8 to 10, as well as Romans 14, where he appeals to the way we ought to eat. We should never eat in such a way that causes someone else to stumble. This involves sacrificing food to idols. Even although Christ has conquered the demons and so forth, nevertheless, if this is causing somebody else to stumble, if this is causing somebody else to eat, to take food for which they cannot give thanks, you're causing them to, in effect, recapitulate the fall. Because that's what even an Adam did. So we learn that we are not to just be thankful in our foods, in our eating, but through communion we learn to be self-giving as well. I show them Jiro Dreams of Sushi. Anyone seen that? It's my favorite documentary. If you want to convey the sanctity of food, have your students watch this film. They love it. I show it every year, and bar none, they love it. Jiro Ono is a 90-year-old sushi chef. He's considered the greatest in the world, and it shows how he prepares food, and it is stunning. It is Edenic. He is more Christian in his eating than I am. He is amazing. It is so beautiful, and it moves students to see someone treat art and food, life-giving things, so sacredly. It's very, very powerful. And then they also read a couple of chapters, if you know Robert Capon's work, The Supper of the Lamb. There's beautiful symbolic elements to eating there. Testing and evaluation, they just get basic prompt questions that have them think about that. You might want to take, I don't know if that's on your syllabus, but if you want to take a picture, that those are some of the prompt questions that I use throughout. In terms of the testing proper, just basically the theological foundations, the schools of thought of aesthetics, get into each music, art, architecture, food. And then they do a final project at the end. They don't do a final, they do a final project. I figure we've been talking about and thinking about aesthetics, they might as well embody it at the end. So they choose, I set aside 2 weeks, and they choose any sense that they want to focus on. The only thing is they just need to be able to relate it to one of those schools of aesthetics and talk about how it redeems our senses. And generally, I finish off the year with a wonderful one-hour BBC documentary, Why Beauty Matters, by the English classical philosopher Roger Scruton. If you want to keep in touch, you can go to my website, charlietalks.com. That book, Beauty Matters, that we were talking about yesterday, is free for you at the conference. You can get a free download for that just for the next few days, just for the conference. And you'll also get an opportunity to get one of my courses on transformative teaching for free. I'm supposed to give you a code if you're interested. You can just write this down. If you're a school, if you put in Beauty Matters and then just a dash, what is it, an underscore, so it's a, it's not a, right, it's Beauty Matters and then it's just like a flat line there. ACCS 2018, and I hope I did, if I said free, I meant 50% off. It's not free there, but so for 50% off, you get Beauty Matters, or it's a dash, underscore, ACCS 2018. If you're an individual, it's Beauty Matters, then underscore, and then RTR, Repairing the Ruins, RTR 2013. If you want to keep talking, we got a gatherings meeting in just about 10 minutes across the hall there. Love to have you there in which room? Rock Hill Room. And if you, yeah, my books are gone. Sorry. So there's some there. I think there's a couple President Trump ones. No, he's lonely. Bring him home with you. And then some healthcare sharing. But if you would like any one of these sent to you, but without any shipping and handling, just sign up for it. It's over at the Scola Inbound Marketing. We'll send it out to you because you get a reduced price of $7 or something like that. So anyway, there you go. If you want to keep up the conversation, meet me over at that Rock Hill Room in about 10 minutes. God bless everyone. Thank you.